Well, hi everybody and welcome. This is Dave Kruger. I'll ask you to mute star six when we have an open discussion at the beginning and the very end, just to manage the background noise because there are a number of people on the call. Welcome to Coaching Money Mastery, to look together at understanding your money relationships and revise money stories, and especially how to work with clients and do that. So I'm eager to collaborate with you. First, I'd like to ask you, while we still have an open mic, if you feel like answering out loud, please feel free to do so, but definitely at some point, maybe now if you have an immediate response, to write down your answers to these two questions. What's the most important question you want answered during this seminar series? For you, the most important question. And secondly, if you were to walk away at the end of these four seminars saying it's been immensely useful for you, what would you walk away with specifically? If anybody would like to volunteer an answer to either or both questions, I welcome that. I don't want to pressure you to do that because you may want to think about it. But if you have especially a response to what's the most important thing you'd like to focus on for you and your work with clients, I'd welcome hearing that. At this point, and feel free to interrupt me during our open mic sessions. I'm going to put us on lecture mode in just a moment so you don't have to worry about that. But I would like you, not out loud, but to write down your answer as immediately as you think about it, as immediately as you hear the question to these two, and I'll explain why, and I'll come back to this later and discuss it. First question, in one word, the first word you think of, what does money mean to you? Just write down one word, what money means to you. Number two, write down one figure. What is your current annual income? Just to write down something. And three, what would your current annual income need to be for you to be happy about money, no worries, financial contentment? So I'll come back to those, but they form a kind of framework to begin to think about your money story and then to look at how you may work with clients in addressing theirs. So I want to just mention there's an outline and a workbook at the link you received when you registered. If any of you have any trouble finding it, email me. And there's also the four ports that the recordings will be posted. Actually, I'll send you the link so that you don't have to worry about finding it or emailing me, just in case you misplaced it or don't have it. I'll send everyone the link to the recording. So any thoughts, any questions, any framework you'd like to be sure we discuss before I go on lecture mode and we launch into our first seminar? And I'll reserve some time at the end for clarification and discussion. Anything from any of you? Well, I welcome your input directly with questions during the seminar at the beginning and end, or simply send me anything you'd like to be sure you want to include in an email, and I'll wrap it into our discussion. And that's the purpose of the two questions, the most important question you have and what you'd like to walk away with. When I hear from you about what your interests are, I'll incorporate that into our discussion. So I'll sort of follow the outline. At the link, there's an outline you can print, so you can, it's fairly annotated, so you can really just listen to the recording or listen to the actual discussion without having to take a whole bunch of notes. So I'm going to put us on lecture mode, and we'll come back and have a discussion at the end. So in this first seminar, we're going to talk about your relationship with money and the power of your money story. The remaining three seminars will look at the principles and practice of systematically examining and crafting your money story. We're going to combine the art of fulfillment and the science of achievement in doing this. Although we'll discuss applications to your money story, you'll see that the principles are fundamental to all that you do in mentor coaching to focus on change, growth, and success. So my mission here is to really look with you at the way you think, specifically to help you examine and understand your relationship with money and map new possibilities and choices to write a new money story. My hope is to guide you maybe also to look around the corner at the next years and decades of your life. What you do today can affect the quality and choices, perhaps even the longevity of those tomorrows. And my stretch goal, since you asked, is to have this work together make a positive, powerful difference for you for the rest of your life. So as we go through these seminars, I'd suggest that you actually do the exercises in the accompanying workbook. At least choose the ones that you particularly don't want to do, because that will be the best indication of looking at things that may not be in your default mode and encoded to be automatic responses. Then you're going to be in the best position to coach it. From Columbia University, we remember 2% of what we hear, 25% of what we see, and 90% of what we do. So put it into action. Let's talk about a very specific relationship you're in right now and a story you're writing. You're writing a story that you may not know exactly how to tell. It's a very personal story with its own history and language. It's highly visible to others, but often not to you. It's a story you talk about every day, think about several times a day. It's remarkably simple and at the same time intricately complex. This story has an internal and an external dialogue, and I'll give you some examples of that in a moment, a secret language, encrypted messages. It's complicated because some important aspects are emotional, unspoken, even unconscious. This story is the longest relationship you'll have in your life. Your parents discussed it before you arrived. People will deliberate it after you're gone. Maybe you'll get 10 years out of a car, maybe 30 to 50 with a spouse, but this story you can never stop writing or living. You can't break up with it, run away with it, or coax it into loving you more. Even though it's unexamined and elusive, you orient life decisions around it. I spoke to a very well-known owner of a publishing house, and we were talking about a book, and his response as we were talking about this was, "You know, Dave, I don't know how to tell this story to myself in order to know what to change." That's what we're about to do. You alone determine the genre of this story, fiction or nonfiction, tragedy or triumph. This story ghostwrites every aspect of a life story, from what you eat and drink to what you plan and play. Health, recreation, stress, even the water you drink are all impacted. At times, You've probably used this story to regulate your moods, adjust self-esteem, up or down, influence others, and maybe try to soothe emotional pains. And how you live this story will be what you teach your children and your clients and your employees. What they see in your behavior and hear, even sense, will be downloaded into their own software, incorporated as part of their own story. The villain or hero is the most popular legal substance to all people of the world. It speaks to you, and you speak with it. It's your money. Lauren Isley observed in The Unexpected Universe, reality has a way of hiding from even its most gifted observers. So, let's consider, in addition to the questions I posed, two other questions. These are just to write down and maybe not respond to immediately, but schedule an appointment with yourself, 10 or 15 minutes, to really think about, reflect on these two questions. What's your money story? And secondly, what would you ideally like your money story to be? First, what is a money story? Your money story is not your income, expenses, assets, debt, your net worth, your investment portfolio. It's your relationship with money, the plot and storylines of your money autobiography. Your money story is at times the secret language of money at work. It's the unconscious tale you continually tell yourself about what you say with it, what money means to you, what you think money says about you. It's a running dialogue of how much you think you deserve, how much you think you're worth, how much you believe you're capable of. And it also, in your mind, maybe, what would happen if you had more? What would happen if you had less? So here are some examples, some ways that we speak with money. We speak simply and straightforwardly. Money says whatever you tell it to. It can convey any language. Money can represent anything. It's a stand-in for what we idealize and desire, but also what we fear and lack, or for what we covet, crave, spurn, chase, or follow. We can use money to show how much we care or how little. We use it to measure success and buy happiness, or try to. We use it to bolster self-esteem at times, to regulate moods, to influence others. In other words, we use money to communicate. We also speak with money and use it as a tool. We give money meaning. We breathe life into it, give it emotional value, build a relationship with it, and make it bigger than it is. We use money to try to soothe emotional pains, maybe buy the respect of others, even for ourselves. We use money as a self-statement. Money can make any statement. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. All that you say is about yourself. A life story or money story manifests through self-statements. The story tells most about the teller. Look back at that one word you wrote about what money means to you. Here are some possibilities. Freedom. Caring. Happiness. Power. Security. Worth. Love. Control. Possibility. We each have an individual meaning for money. Think about, and this is what I recommend, and many of you know this and have heard this before. When you make a recommendation to your client for your coaching services, I would suggest using a kind of planned recommendation that's clear, brief, simple, and specific, that covers everything you do and what you recommend with confidence and clearly and specifically to that client. And the last word you use in that entire two or three ideally sentences, the last word you use is the amount of your fee. If you do a monthly retainer for those standing appointments, material and resources, and whatever emails, then my monthly retainer is blank. So whatever you decide. Because when someone hears a figure of money, they are often off to the races because they have ingrained meanings, like the word you wrote, from before there were words in a language about what money meant to their parents, how they saw people who had less or more, the kind of meanings you gave to it. So everybody has an initial meaning. So think about how when someone has their own association, they have a little bit more vying for their attention than just your recommendation of professional coaching services. So if somebody sees money as greed, they're off in one direction. As if they see it as freedom, they're going to give up some of their freedom to talk to you. If they see it as love, man, I'd rather give it to somebody who really appreciates. There are a lot of associations people can have that move away from the primary discussion and impetus of that recommendation that you're about to make. So think about the story that meaning for you can initiate. This car is going to show what I'm worth. This will make people respect me. This will validate me. If it means greed, then are you associated as a professional with greed, with freedom? They're going to give up some of their freedom to pay you money? So that's these are a few of the reasons that you want it to be last, so that it simply is money, and because it never is. So when you treat it with objectivity and in a simple way, you'll come to see all the various attachments that people have to money. You know, an obvious example is the self-statement of spending money, conspicuous consumption. You buy a red BMW convertible and drive it in the middle of a busy street. Contemptuous consumption, you buy that red BMW in the middle of a midlife crisis and drive it by your ex-wife's house. No, these are not self-statements. I would never buy a red BMW. Without realizing it, we use money every day to tell a story about ourselves and our lives. We use it in self-talk, in the messages we tell ourselves. For example, these may be a little more conscious than you wish they were, so they're at least pre-conscious. People who have significant money are lucky. People with real money are different from me. You have to work really hard to make money. Truly spiritual people don't have money or wealth. Money, I think, can buy happiness. Money means the same to everybody. Now, in an external dialogue, part of what keeps the language of money a secret is it remains largely unspoken. Our social conventions create some pairings of spoken and unspoken agreements. We can speak of a woman's dress size, but not her weight. We can discuss cost of plastic surgery, but not someone's age. We can debate financial markets and economies, but not personal income or debt. Ask the host of your next dinner party, how much money do you make? And you probably won't see the next dinner. Ask, what's the amount of debt you have? You may not see dessert. Here's a real-life example. An agent at a writer's conference discussed working with her authors over the years. She talked about the details of some of her contract negotiations. Someone else in the audience, this was a number of years ago when I was in that audience, someone in the audience asked, and it wasn't me, would you talk about how much money's involved in the book deals so that we can get an idea of what to expect. Already an hour of the allotted 75 minutes for her presentation, the discussion had already passed, and it looked like she wasn't. So she looked shocked. Her immediate response was, well, I've always felt you don't talk about money. And she was looking as if she were trying to compose herself and figure out what to say. An older guy from the back row, also not me, said, I thought once you finished the book, you finally do talk about money. You shut down your computer, change out of your sweats, and start selling your book. Well, of course he was right. His frankness and confrontation sparked a really lively discussion about money and contracts. The presenter then talked about specific figures and went on to lead a discussion that was immensely useful to her audience interested in writing books, part of them at least, for a living. Now, here's an internal dialogue. We may not speak openly of something, but our inner voice never gives up the conversation. We have dialogues in our minds before making a decision to exchange our money, our time and energy, for something else. See if any of this applies. Every exchange involves two asking prices, financial and emotional. The conversation that's often silent and automatic has many dialects. Here are some examples. It was the debate I had with myself in my first official job at the ripe age of 8. That was before child labor laws. I earned 10 cents a row, this tells you how long ago it was too, chopping cotton for my dad on hot summer days. When school started, I saw my classmates enjoying soda and candy after lunch that they had purchased, and I joined them. Immediately, I realized that Coke cost one row of chopping cotton. That candy cost a half row of chopping cotton. And in a good morning, I could maybe, these were long, sweaty rows, I could get in maybe 8, and in a really good morning, 10 rows. So that tells you how long ago it was. So my immediate question, my treats were gone, and I immediately asked, was that candy worth half a row of chopping cotton? And did I get enough in this soft drink to pay one row of cotton chopping? My very quick answer was no to both questions. That helped me later with my own kids talk about not just the allocation of money, like, you know, how to create a good system for, you know, a clothes allowance for school for the year, but also to talk about the cost of money, how much it costs to get money and what you're willing to pay for that. Another example, at an elaborate birthday party, the parent unconsciously whispers, I'll give you what I never had as a child. Or the preamble to spending may need to be rationalization for someone. Well, this is a lot of money to spend on a huge plasma screen, big screen TV. But if I amortize it over 10 years, it's only 32 cents a day. That's, of course, rationalized spending. Now, we regard the same dollar differently depending on how it's obtained. Found money can be consumed frivolously. Gifted money, usually spent without debate. But salary or professional fees, after serious comparative charge. Savings, only with definite need or emergency. This is a framing bias. It's the same dollar. The dollar doesn't even know who owns it. Just like the war bonds didn't know the war was going on. It's treated differently based on its context. From a recent documentary, a woman on the verge of declaring her fourth bankruptcy said, you know, still, the high from shopping is more powerful than the low from bankruptcy. Or the parent who says, I spend so much time at work when I'm off, I like to buy my children something to make up for it, a kind of justification bias. A compromise occurs when two money stories occur simultaneously, and this is what you may be listening for with your client. The surface story, for example, I want to make significant money and accumulate wealth. The shadow story, from that 90 to 95% of the operating system that's not conscious, I don't think I have what it takes, or making a lot of money is unspiritual, or, you know, I'm afraid if I really put everything into it and then fail, I'd really feel ashamed. Another simple example of a dual story, the surface story, I want to claim my freedom and become my own authority. The shadow story, well, I can't have total authority because my partner acts like I'm taking it away when I do that. Now, money also speaks to us. We're changing perspectives here to see what a plurality of perspectives and issues there are with that simple and single dollar bill. A study was done in which volunteers had their brain scanned using fMRI scans when they tasted five different Cabernet Sauvignon. I have some elaborate mechanisms to get research from around the world, even to correspond with researchers in neuroeconomics, NAP, but I can never find studies like this to volunteer for. The volunteers were told before tasting the price of each of the wines. They rated the wines, as you might expect, according to price, the most expensive one the best, on down to the least expensive as last. And their brains corresponded. The area of their brains that encode the pleasantness of an experience registered exactly the experience that corresponded with the cost of the wine. With the more expensive wine, their brains registered more pleasure in their pleasure center. Now, it was the same wine. The experience registered according to their perception of the cost. And this is how money can sometimes communicate to us just below the level of our conscious awareness. It speaks to us as a confidant, a seducer, an adversary, a protector, a drug. Money can be a tangible container for various things. Look at what you wrote down as your first response to that quote. What money means to you, hope, freedom, ambition, love, a number of things that have personal meaning to you. Money is the one true metaphor that can stand for anything else. Now, look at the other two questions that you wrote down. Your current annual income. And to ensure happiness and contentment financially, no more money problems or worry, what your annual income would need to be. I've given this quiz to hundreds of people over the years for more, and this would be like in a presentation after one of the books I've done on money come out. So these are a number of different groups of people all the way through and including top executives, but a number of people just in usual settings, social settings. For more than 90% of those who respond, I'd send an index card around numbered 1 through 3 and ask them to write the answers to these questions in confidence and to send them back anonymously and confidentially, and then would tally them later. So here's the finding that more than 90% would feel that it would take about twice as much than they're making now to really be happy. This was as true for somebody who was making $50,000 as it was for somebody who was making $250,000. They thought it would take about twice as much. And in follow-up studies, as I was able to access the group again, when they reached, this was at like 1 and 3 years, when they reached their what it would take for me to be happy goal, there was a trailing double. And the one, for example, the ones who were making $100,000 thought it would take, when they reached $200,000, they thought it would take pretty close to $375,000 or $400,000 in order to really be happy. So this also brings into sharp focus What is enough? More is not a goal. Perfect is not a goal. There's no end point to wanting more. There's no limit to what you don't have. And when you focus on what you don't have, you ensure dissatisfaction, most likely. So in these money equations, money can make any statement: worth, autonomy, security, freedom, love, opportunity, power. The secret language becomes most developed by emotionally powerful desires. Unmet needs show up as symbolic wants. A desire is not quieted by its satisfaction, and desires can be created by filling them. And money is the legal tender of desires. Money becomes the ink blot of the Rorschach test. When our eyes look straight at it, there's only a design on paper. But if offered the chance to imbue that design with meaning, the interpretations will be the projection of a varied number of meanings, fantasies, experiences of the person who's creating it. People may think money is a reflection of their self-worth or their morals. One woman said, I don't know why money is getting the best of me. I have good morals. I shouldn't have money problems. Well, money isn't related to morals, necessarily. Action gets you money. Smart action gets you more. Efficiency keeps your money. Or at times, their ethics. President Obama said, if you work hard in America, you shouldn't be poor. Well, you may work hard, but you may overspend, gamble, have five kids, three of whom are in college, or live in the Upper East Side of Manhattan, or have a shopping addiction. So it's not a given. So this is a question for you to consider. Who in America has the best work ethic? Think about that for a minute. Who in America do you think has the very best work ethic? What group or location or kind of job or, you know, race, socioeconomic, any variable, who do you think has the best work ethic? If you're ready for the answer, here's my answer. Heroin addicts. They get up every morning. They have to hustle 7 days a week plus holidays. Well, that's the same. 365 days a year. They can't let a single day go by without working. And it's not because their self-esteem suffers. One heroin addict summarized it by saying, if I don't get up early tomorrow morning and hustle all day, the next day I'll die. So I mention this to not confuse work ethic with performance ethic, especially with success ethic. You've probably heard someone, well, I was at my desk all day. I was there 8 hours, 10 hours. That's not what we coach. We coach for someone to create a successful performance and to get to their goal step by step. Why do we make these money errors? The more we give money meaning, the more we lose focus on what money really means. And then we can do strange things with money. Here are just some examples. Intelligent people spend money they don't have. Sophisticated people get scammed, sometimes repeatedly. Reasonable people forego pleasure to pursue money in order to purchase back a portion of what they just forfeited. Think about that. They forego pleasure to pursue money and then have to purchase back a portion only of what they just forfeited. Otherwise, gifted people may not be able to convert their talent into sufficient income. And think of the usual association that we may have, starving artists. Why should someone of exceptional talent be accepting of that epithet of being starving? This is where we come into play as coaches to address that and not that assumption. Otherwise, balanced individuals can spend extravagantly and hoard compulsively. Otherwise, dependable people ignore financial matters until it's serious at times. highly principled people can step over boundaries and write their own rules. This is something that we see regularly. And we talk about hubris, where someone becomes caught up in the entire mood and state of feeling and being more powerful, winking at boundaries. Here's a simple early example that others can be taught from the beginning. Burton Watson, CEO of Cybernet, conned investors out of $120 million. As a boy, Burton's mother would tell him, exceptionally wealthy and exceptionally intelligent people don't have to follow the rules. That's an early message. Burton listened to his mama. The messages will keep repeating themselves. People will keep writing the same money stories that imprison them until they're listened to and strategically changed. So also think about how money has become more abstract. The vast majority of our money management occurs not through our hands, our broker's hands, or in our bank account, but inside our minds, in a complex interplay of thoughts, emotions, and neurological wiring. Here's a 22-second history of money, since you asked. First, two goats were exchanged for five bags of rice. Then, coins enter as a symbol of value, a unit of exchange. Coins were then replaced by paper bills, then paper checks, then plastic, then a pure abstraction of numbers stored and traded as configurations of electrons. As money becomes more abstracted, transactions are easier, but our understanding of money fades and our relationship with it changes. This is a very simple example of that abstraction. People spend 23% more when they pay by credit card than they do by cash or check, because there's a different level of abstraction of a credit card and putting it into the future combined. So let's look at the mind matters and brain business of this subject. What's the role of the mind and brain in money behaviors and financial decisions? The answer is everything. So why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will someone repeat behavior that doesn't work, often do it harder, and expect a different result, even when it leads to maybe lower energy, debt, plateaued careers, or disappointing relationships? Nassim Taleb asks in his book, The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So here's a part of the answer to why we resist change. It's in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure and predictable. A comfort zone may be limiting. It may be uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's a default mode. We repeat because we know how it's going to turn out. That creates the illusion of effectiveness. A new story generates uncertainty and trepidation. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality, the internal map that's synonymous with identity. We always tend to return to our default mode. So let's do just a very brief exercise. Put your palms together and interlock your fingers. Now, you've been doing that for a long time. Notice with that firm clasping together, where your palms are firmly against each other and interlocking fingers, notice which thumb's on top. Now, keep your fingers exactly the same, but chained so that the other thumb is on top. How does that feel? Just a little bit awkward? Now, move your thumbs back to their original place. Now, that's kind of really, that's the way things ought to be. That's why people don't change or succeed remarkably or at times derail when they do. They return to their comfort zone. Now, up the ante. add significant success or significant stress, such as major transition, really out of a comfort zone. We're going to talk more about comfort zones and how to program change. And the principle for us for coaching, there's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. That will always be the dialectic with each client. Now, the other part of the answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. Here's an illustration of this. Some of you have heard me use this illustration before. The hypnotherapist, Dr. Milton Erickson, told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. Even from a young age, he was very, very creative and mischievous. He intentionally created a circuitous path, zigzags, indirect turns. He noticed that each person who followed him followed the same path. The end of the day, the path was well worn, despite it being really circuitous. Not a single person started a new, more direct route. No matter how many turns and twists, each person in turn followed the path of least resistance. This is how neural pathways are laid down in our brains, by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply. Even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous and require way more work, to think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of usual experience. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. The catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus. New information, new context, are simply a question from you as a coach that will break the script to ask the client to think about it in a different way or ask a question that they'll have to create the answer instead of doing something that's in their default mode. The catalyst for insight, this new information, this new context, is what we do as coaches in breaking the script. So we're going to talk about this juncture in particular, when your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar to engage new behavior. The uncertainty of this newness will often be experienced as discomfort or some trepidation, and it can be misread as, my intuition is telling me this is wrong, or my gut says I've made a mistake, instead of framing it as a signpost of change and progress. So this discomfort with every client you have, every time they take a step into the new and the unproven and not yet experienced, will be attendant with some degree of trepidation and uncertainty. When that is either misinterpreted or when you get a read that this is the experience of the client, this is a time for an empathic resonance to recognize the discomfort in order to help the client frame it in a way that fosters growth and moving ahead. To look at it from a brain perspective, at that moment, the brain can't tell the difference between excitement and anxiety. If it's read as anxiety, if this discomfort of taking a step into the new and different, even though well planned, if it's read as anxiety or some kind of negative discomfort, it makes sense to stop, better head for cover. If it's read, if it's framed as excitement, as opportunity and challenge, then there's a looking for the next step and to create a system to continue moving ahead. This is the juncture that we operate as coaches. At that instant where someone is framing an experience so that the framing, which will boot up an entire mindset to process the remainder of the conversation, so that you're helping a client look at the challenge, at the opportunity to co-create a new story with you at that moment. This is the choice architecture of our operation as coaches. We never have to go back into the past or ask why questions or look at what happened or didn't happen in someone's childhood, because every algorithm that is important in that person's experience and how they're constructing their story will be evident to you and listening to the process as a coach. If, let's say, let's use a very simple example. I'm ready to launch my business, but I really need to be a little more comfortable and confident in order to do it. Those are two limiting assumptions combined. I need to be confident in order to proceed. I need to be comfortable in order to move ahead in my business. Either one of those can be limiting. This is the process. This is that 90 to 95% of the operating system that may not be fully conscious, at least in the way that it may need to be for your client. So we're listening for the process of how they construct their story and as they construct it in a way to further the progress and the process of what you're co-creating, then that's dynamite. If they limit themselves, you're going to see exactly how they limit themselves. Your client is going to show you, moment by moment, exactly what it's like to be that client. And this is the process you're listening for. We're going to return to that. So we struggle to embrace change. Many of the methods to facilitate change are really contrary to the way the mind and brain work. Neuroscience, quantum physics, strategic coaching have a lot to teach us about change and resistance to change. Our money stories actually tell us less about money and more about the human mind and its operation. At times, both our minds and our brains can work against us. When you think with one part of the brain and feel with another, you need a map. We're going to incorporate some groundbreaking research from different disciplines with strategic coaching to understand resistance to change and understand and guide strategies of change. We have to outsmart our brain at times. We can reprogram our minds and rewire our brains to create wealth and success. We're going to talk about how to do that using a system beginning next seminar. And you know from coaching, if you want to change, don't focus just on the goal. Winners and losers have the same goal. Focus on the system. That's exactly what we do as coaches. Each time we begin a session and ask a client, what would you like to focus us to focus on for this session? And then, what would you like us to get to? That's a map. That's a mini system that the client can download and take with them when they're not talking to you. So how do we get our brains to work with us in creating money stories? Now, the brain has a mind of its own, and we are often of two or more minds. Neuroscientists study the responses and functioning of the brain by using functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, like in the wine study I mentioned. It's a video of the brain in action and how the brain responds to different situations. So these studies have disproven a long-standing assumption that we have a consistent and predictable set of preferences and responses, and that we choose based on logic. Behavioral economics for some time has looked at, instead of how people think they decide and look at things, how they really think and look at things. Different parts of the brain operate in radically different ways. Money behavior and financial decisions are linked to both mind dynamics and brain activity. So we're going to use some of these findings in a practical way to inform certain decisions. And here's a glimpse at some examples. Now, as a sidebar here, I want to mention to you, I don't talk to clients and the way I'm talking to you guys. This is for training purposes. The exercises and work tools you may use occasionally with a client. But what I'm talking about with you is a way to understand how the mind and brain works, understand conceptually how we can go about collaboratively facilitating an alliance and an examination and a systematic way to create change. This is for your information, not how you talk or not what you try to do or educate clients. Because if you try to provide logic, information, data, that won't work. And we'll come back to that and talk about why. So here are just some examples of how the mind dynamics and brain activity inform certain decisions. The prefrontal cortex says, well, let's think about the 12-month game plan and retirement savings. But the limbic system says, ah, relax, let's have a single malt and order that 27-inch iMac. And my amygdala even specifies the type of single malt. Each part struggles with the same dollar, hopefully without tearing it, as we talked before. Emotions do not simply and only corrupt decision-making. As you know, the emotional brain can hijack and hold hostage the logical brain. Emotions narrow attention and compress focus on the immediate. But those who do not use emotion are not good at making decisions. Making people happy is simply giving them more of what they prefer has been disproven. The brain's pleasure center quickly accommodates to new stimuli and expects them to continue. This is how people create habits and addictions. David Geffen says, anyone who believes that money makes you happy obviously doesn't have money. When someone's stock portfolio does well, they may impute this to their talent and smartness, and it could be. Gamblers can interpret good fortune as skill. I know this. My wife and I played heads-up poker for a long period of time, and she finally confessed to me that one of my tells, she asked me, Dave, would you like me to tell you what one of your tells is? And I said, yeah. She said, if I happen to draw a really lucky hand, I have a slightly smug look, like I think I'm brilliant. That sounded exactly like me. So I knew what not to do from that point on. So the important thing about your money story is to really ask objectively what works and what doesn't work. The components at work may not need fixing. And we know from coaching, if it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. The ones that don't work need to be revised and understood in order to embrace your money and your life stories, and especially to determine what's really about money and what hitchhikes on money. And I'll tell you the answer beforehand. Most of it is not really about money, but money's the Rorschach. It's the metric because it's tangible and specific. But at the same time, your life can be changed significantly by changing your money story. Money's a magnifier. Like adversity, it rewards certain action. It reveals character. Whoever a person is, excess money will exaggerate. If a person's a problem drinker, money will make them more drunk. If somebody's insecure, money will make them more paranoid. If someone is caring and generous, money can help them become a better philanthropist. The most fundamental understanding about our relationship with money is not a depth understanding of money or finances. It's about understanding how our minds and brains work and how that affects our behavior, including our money behavior. The beliefs and decisions and seemingly inexplicable behavior involving money, for the large part, aren't really about money per se. Money is a portable to the immaterial and the intangible, a portal. So, for us, we began this journey over these four seminars to understand the choice architecture of your money story. You write your money story, you live it, you can revise it, or write an informed, powerful new money story. And to the extent that you are successful with that, you, I believe, will be in the very best position that you can be to help your clients do the same thing and not have it be about you at all, but keep the point of reference entirely with the client and helping the client develop their story. So I'm going to take us off lecture mode and take any questions or comments that you have. I'm interested in hearing your reflections. Okay, we're in discussion mode.
Hi, David.
Now. Yes. Go ahead.
This is Sammy again.
I'm sorry. Would you get a little closer to your microphone? It's kind of staticky. Let me ask everyone who's not speaking to go on mute, either the mute button or star six. So that'll help with the background noise. Thanks. Go ahead, please. Would you try again?
It's Danny Bedoni.
Thanks. Go way better. Go ahead. I'm kind of losing a few words.
Once you give money to people who need it,
I'm not really picking up what you're saying. Can you spin around a couple of times and see if you can get better reception, or maybe take it off your speakerphone or headset? I'm really interested in your question, and I'm not getting it.
Hi.
Way better. Go ahead. Thank you.
So the money, neurologically speaking, becomes a portal, as you said, to generosity for other people. So money is a multiplier, and then you start seeing the positive sides of things when it's not about you, but you give it to others.
Yes. Is there a question from that that you have or want me to comment on specifically?
Yes. So the question is, if that is the thought of money, how can we as fundraisers and clients that I have that need to fundraise, how can we put this into a headline? How can I use this in our coaching so people understand?
That's a great question, and there are entire studies of this. An important thing in fundraising is to be as specific as possible about what this is doing for the people you're interested in doing it with. If it's at the level of abstraction, then someone is not going to be emotionally invested. At the level of abstraction, if you indicate that the donation would be to help starving kids in Nigeria, that's a laudable and a notable goal. But here's what will increase in one study the level of donations by 25%. This is Royka, a 7-year-old who is hungry. So it's a very specific, focused application, and people respond emotionally to the picture of Royka and not to the abstraction of hungry people somewhere in the world I may have never been before, and it's a great cause. I hope it works. So that also, if we think about the parallel, when you ask a client what you want to work on, the client begins to talk about goals or abstractions and where they want to get to and their plans, you begin in a different way. You create a map with that person for this discussion, whether it's a 20-minute sample session or a 50-minute regular session, by asking, what would you like us to focus on together for this time? And then, where would you like us to get to? So you've just created a map, a focus and a map, for this discussion. That has specificity. often when people resist or just decline, say, to donate or resist change in some way, it's because they don't know exactly what the next step is. So obviously people know what they're donating to, but they have no idea what the fate of that dollar is. And every time we give up money, that is registered in the pain center, the nucleus here. That registers as pain, which is why credit card debt is 23% greater, because there's not the pain of payment until later. It's tomorrow's another day. Next month, I'll take care of it. Only the pleasure center gets stimulated with a credit card purchase. So you're stimulating the pleasure center by having the specificity of that donation. That's just one possibility. And there are others that, you know, you may want to consider. I have helped my daughter, who has a foundation, think about this in some ways, and I put together some thoughts. Email me if you'd like me to send a copy of what I sent to her in looking at some things for that might benefit her foundation in Boston. So, great question. Does that help for right now, at least?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, thank you.
Okay, super. Great. Yeah, email me, and I'll send you a... I think I can locate what I put together for. I know we're essentially out of time, but any other question or comment before we wrap up today? Send me any responses you have. I'll send out a reminder of the location of the playback and all that. Send me I'll send out these two questions. You know, what you most like to focus on during this series and what you'd most like to take away. It will help me orient some of the responses and discussion. So thanks very much, and I appreciate your energy and attention. I look forward to hearing from you and to picking up right here next time, where we'll approach this in a much more systematic way of looking at it. So thanks very much. Take good care of yourselves. Have a great week. Bye now. See you guys.
Thank you.
Absolutely.